Ira Glass is the host and creator of the public radio program This American Life. The show is heard each week by over 2.2 million listeners on more than 500 public radio stations, with another 2.2 million downloading the podcast. For years, the podcast of This American Life was the most popular podcast on iTunes, until the show started its first spinoff program, Serial, which quickly became the most popular podcast ever created. In his live show, Reinventing Radio, Ira will return to the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock to talk about how they put together This American Life, what makes a compelling story, and where they find the amazing tales. He mixes stories from the show live on stage, recreating the sound of the program, and he plays funny and memorable moments from the show as well, and talks about what goes on behind their creation. It is always a pleasure to welcome Ira Glass to the roundtable. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. How long have you been doing this type of thing, this reinventing radio program?
I mean, I've been doing some version of giving a talk about the show probably for 19 years. Suddenly it sounds awful. For 19 years, like what long-running play tours for 19 years. But I started it. Our radio show has been on the air for 20 years. And then as soon as we became a national show, then I started touring around to stations and giving talks about the radio show just to publicize the fact that we existed. And I would do like one a month.
And this has obviously evolved to the point where now you go out and it's you, an iPad, and a lot of sound.
Yes. And when it started, honestly, like when it started, my very first speech that I had to give for the show was in Minnesota, and it was at McAllister College. And I hadn't been on stage. I was in my late 30s, and I hadn't been on stage since I was in college, because like most adults, I don't stand up on a stage ever in my job. And I was just like, I don't really know what it is to give a speech. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just like I'll be calm if I can make this as much like a radio show as I can. And I asked that they get a little sound mixer. They didn't even have CD players that you could use. I had like little mini disc players with sound. And I sat on the stage at basically sort of a mini radio studio that we set up on stage. And I talked and played clips and played sound. And now the technology has changed so much. I'm doing the same thing, but you know, I can run all the sound from an iPad.
And when you run the sound, you will have, it's different tracks, isn't it? It's the music.
It's, oh, yeah, it's multi-track mixing. No. There's music running underneath me, and there's quotes, and there's sound. Like, I'm recreating the sound of the radio show, and then I can ride the levels because that little iPad gives me a full mixer.
So another way of asking the question is, I assume a lot can go wrong.
Yes.
And you like that.
I do, but I have to say a lot can go wrong, but it's not that complicated.
No.
And and I'm very, very experienced. So not a lot does go wrong. And in fact, the thing I've learned just by going out and giving the talk, and then there was a period where about 2 years ago I was touring to promote a movie that I did with one of our contributors, Mike Birbiglia, who's a comedian. And so I was on stage all the time with him, and I would watch the way that he would work the room at an event to promote the film. And I was like, oh, I really picked up some moves from watching like a professional who does that all the time. And I feel like I've tried to adapt as much of that into what I can do. Like, I feel like it's a much more loose show, and is better because I feel like I'm ad-libbing way more.
Do you always try to bring something new, or are there fairly set pieces?
There are a few set pieces, but even those have changed, you know, over the last few years. And then, yeah, like I try always to bring something new, just because I get restless giving the same speech over and over.
And for people who have listened to the show and are huge fans of the show, it not only they get to hear some of their favorites again, but as I mentioned in the introduction, get to hear some of the behind the scenes stories.
Yeah, it's very much about like, well, how do we put together the show and stuff that doesn't get on the air, and why it doesn't get on the air, and just the theory behind like, why is this made the way it is? Like, because when we went on the air, we were very different from most things on public radio or anywhere else.
And what do you make of the fact that so many of us in public radio have adapted or adopted the sound that you and your program have?
I mean, I don't think that so many people have. I feel like there's the predominant sound of public radio is still the sound of the big national news magazines, All Things Considered and Morning Edition. I mean, and I feel like occasionally I'll hear a reporter who is, working a more kind of conversational style like we do in our show, or structuring a story around tape the way we do, or kind of thinking about the characters in the story and the story arcs of the people in the story in the way that we do. But I gotta say, like, it isn't super common. And if anything, like, I feel like what's happened is that there's been a world of shows that have come to exist that have been inspired by the sound of our show, that are other weekend shows and podcasts. And so I think Radiolab, you know, you can tell that they heard our show and they invented kind of a more sound rich version of us. And that, honestly, I feel like advances a lot on the way something sounds from what we do. And The Moth and Snap Judgment and other things like that took elements of things they heard us do and then added their own and took away some things that they thought didn't work. And I don't know. Like, so I feel like there's definitely a corner of the public radio world that we've influenced, but it's a very particular corner.
How conscious in the beginning was it for you to change the sound of what you were hearing on public radio, or how much of it was just what you felt radio should be? And that's what it became.
I was consciously trying to make something along different principles than the way the rest of public radio was made. I was incredibly conscious. I did not have as a goal the idea of changing the sound of public radio, because that seemed unreachable and crazy. Like, I just thought, like, I think that although I love the news programs and I had been a longtime staffer on All Things Considered Morning Edition, I had come to different conclusions about, like, what I think would be more effective and more gripping on the radio, and I wanted to enact those based on things, you know, that I was doing in a smaller scale.
So when it comes to the overall program and how it began and what you have now 20 years later, is it still all on you, or has that evolved into many different people doing many different things?
Oh, one of the great things about it now is that it's many different people doing many different things, and that it's people with really different opinions about what would be good, and that there's space for like just a lot of talking about it and making stuff. Like, that's what's wonderful about it, actually. I mean, when we started the show, you know, it was me and three other people. Now it's a dozen of us making it, and you know, and people are interested in different things, and it's a much more diverse staff, and I feel like in every way that makes it better, and it makes it more fun for me.
Has success in any way made it more difficult to do what you do?
The only way it's more difficult is that now I will get into a situation, easily half the interviews I do are with people who have heard of me or heard me on the air. And there is no upside to that at all. It just makes them nervous. And then I have to kind of undo that in their heads and turn myself back into a real person and not just like some voice on the radio. And talk to them as a person. That's the one downside. Everything else, honestly, has been upside. I really couldn't have imagined that it would have gone this way, that we'd still be on the air and we'd have, you know, this worldwide audience because of the podcast, and that other shows would have based certain things of what they're doing on what we're doing. And honestly, like, I never understood, because when I started the show as a reporter, I didn't really understand what it was like to work with other people. Like I had worked with other people, like, but I was their producer, you know, on All Things Considered a Morning Edition, but I never really understood like really what it would be like to be so close to so many people and be inventing a thing together in this way.
So inventing what you invented, has it given you an understanding of what people like to hear on the radio over time? As you presented it to them and you get the response, what does that tell you?
I mean, I understand in a tiny, tiny way. I don't feel like I can speak about something so broad, you know? And honestly, like, I feel like we are the worst market-tested show in broadcast history. Or maybe that's not true. Maybe we're exactly as badly market-tested as everything else on public radio, which is to say, we don't go to the audience and poll them and focus group them and ask, like, did you like this kind of segment, or do you like this kind of segment? Or what do you think of this contributor versus this contributor, which they do, you know, on television all the time. And instead, like I and the staff, we're doing a very old-fashioned kind of, like, stick to the golden rule. Like, we make something that we ourselves would be willing to listen to, and then we assume that we're normal, and so anything that we would like, other people would like. And that's it. And so those are our standards. And, you know, and we have high standards. Like, there's a lot of stuff that we would not listen to. Like we're very picky as a staff. But I feel like most people are pretty picky about what they listen to and don't.
In a very general sense, the name of this program is Reinventing Radio. Are we still, as an industry, still reinventing radio? With the numbers that I mentioned in the introduction regarding podcasts and the great success that you and Serial have seen with podcasts, is this all part of the great reinvention?
Absolutely. In fact, some of the most interesting invention being done in audio and in stories told in audio is being done as podcast only. There's so many amazing podcasts going on right now. And it's happening there, I think, because it's so much harder to get anything on the radio. To get something on the radio, you have to take off something that already probably has some sort of audience and success. And it's just a much higher bar to do that. Whereas you can start a podcast with so little money and just an idea.
I don't in any way mean this to be a confrontational question, although it may on the surface seem like it. But then if those numbers keep going up, at what point don't you need us, the member stations, anymore?
Well, I mean, one of the things we know about the numbers is that although over the last decade, This American Life, its audience has gone from like own podcast has gone from like a couple hundred thousand to 2.2 million. Our radio audience has stayed strong. Like, we haven't lost radio audience. Like, that is not coming at the expense of member stations. And, you know, like, so right now, 2.2 million people hear us on the radio. Well, that's a ton of people. Like, that's a huge, huge audience. Like, it's just a phenomenal audience. It's crazy big. So, of course, we would never turn our backs on that. And also just out of sheer idealism, which is why I and most people in public broadcasting get into it. Like, I believe in the idea of having like public radio stations that are actual radio stations that do local news and do local coverage with excellence and offer a variety of things, including us, but also lots of stuff that's nothing like us. I mean, that's the thing that I think that so many of us are working towards.
When you first started, and it's continued very much so, but when you first started especially, you were pointed to, and the program was pointed to, as a way of bringing in younger listeners. We still very much have that discussion within public radio of how we bring in younger listeners. Do you think we as an industry, as public radio industry, are doing enough to do that?
I don't know. I mean, I can tell you we're not doing it. And so, but I, honestly, like, I'm no expert on this part of things about how you would go about getting younger listeners to listen. Like, my understanding is that younger people are not listening to the radio in the same numbers as older people. So first you have to overcome that. And then the second thing you have to do is make programming that younger listeners would want to listen to. And one of the things that NPR has done is that they've done surveys of people who demographically and, you know, who are news consumers, basically, who you'd think would want to listen to public radio, but they don't listen to public radio. And when they ask them, like, well, you know, you're into the news and we make a very nice news product, how come you're not listening to us? The number one reason that people give is that the sound of public radio sounds snooty to them. And I've talked to program directors at WBUR in Boston and elsewhere who talk about the kind of legacy sound of public radio, which is obviously something that, like, I was a producer on All Things Considered. Like, I helped make that sound. And people talk about that as, like, well, that's not such an asset now. Like rethinking that sound and retraining to be something else would be one way to go out and attract new listeners. That's something that public radio could be doing. It's really hard to do. Like, I can't even imagine what it would be like to run NPR and try to take on that task. It means retraining, just thinking about, like, the news staffs, you know, 150, 250 people who are the most skilled at it, like, in the country. Like, these are the very best people in the country at it, and telling them, like, all right, time to relearn what you do and do this other thing that's slightly different that younger people will be listening to. It's like, that is a really unenviable task if they would even decide to do it. I don't know what the answer is, and I wouldn't want to come off being too critical of people who don't see, like, a reasonable way to solve that problem. I mean, you say younger listeners, you know, non-white listeners, you know, and people who haven't gone to college. These are other audiences that public radio could be serving better. And again, I think, like, you know, first and foremost, you have to make programming that people would want to hear, and then you have to inform them that it exists and get them to listen. I mean, there's so many stages to something like that.
When you spoke a moment ago about the sound of public radio, when you started out 20-some years ago, and as you mentioned earlier, the conscious decision to change programming and to do something else, was that part of it, to change that sound?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I say that as like a longtime producer in that sound. Like, yes. I was a Morning Edition, All Things Considered producer. But yeah, like I thought a more conversational sound just works better on the radio, like just straight up. And I think as time has gone on, I think more and more people have come to see that sound feels like it has more authority. Like right now, if you hear somebody giving the news in the style of like Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite, it just seems corny. Like it doesn't carry an authority because it seems so corny. At least to, I think, anybody 50 and under. And I think what carries more authority is the way that, you know, like Jad Abumrad talks or you know, like any of the like younger people who mm-hmm. just sound like people talking in a real way, you know, about stuff that they know is true and that they're journalists and they can, you know, back up and all that. But like I think that it's you know, what connotates authority has changed. And I feel like the internet has done even more to push us in that direction since we're all on these feeds, which are written in a totally conversational style, you know, like it's just written as conversation in a very chatty tone. And so that has become the thing that we're used to.
So you will be back at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall on Sunday afternoon at 3:00. What do you hope people get out of the afternoon?
Fun. Like I'm there for fun. Like I'm there like to amuse myself and others. And that's what I hope. Like when I choose the clips for this, I have lots of funny clips and emotional stuff. And like, that's my cause. It's an afternoon of entertainment with some thinking.
Right. It is entitled Reinventing Radio, an afternoon with Ira Glass at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall this Sunday afternoon at 3:00. And you can find out more information by going to troymusichall.org. Troymusichall.org. 3:00 on Sunday afternoon. Ira Glass, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much, and it'll be good to have you back in town.
Thanks. Nice talking to you, too.
Great. Thank you so much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.